So where were you when the earth shook on Saturday? Somewhere you could feel it? A lot of people in mid-Michigan were. I was not, but a lot of people were, obviously. The progressive website, Addicting Info, is suggesting that the 4.2 Michigan quake, centered near Galesburg, not far from Kalamazoo, may be related to fracking in Barry County. AddictingInfo.org, article by Randa Morris. Ms. Morris writes, earlier this year, the U.S. Geological Survey published the results of a study linking fracking to increased earthquake activity across the central U.S. Of specific concern to scientists is the fossil fuel industry's practice of fracking wastewater injection. At that time, the USGS stated, deep injection of wastewater is the primary cause of the dramatic rise in detected earthquakes and the corresponding increase in seismic hazard in the central U.S. She goes on to write later, between 2010 and 2013, a total of 53 horizontal fracking wells were drilled in 18 Michigan counties. And she links to state government maps that show where fracking is taking place in Michigan. There's none going on in Kalamazoo County, as it turns out, or very little. But she points out that in nearby Barry County, maybe 20 miles or so from the center of the quake, there's a fair amount of fracking activity going on in Barry County. What does it mean? Who knows? Investigate it for yourself. AddictingInfo.org will remind everybody that there is an effort underway to ban fracking in Michigan through the ballot process in November of 2016. We will keep an eye on it. AddictingInfo.org. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. CATA, the Capital Area Transportation Authority, will soon unveil its new multimodal gateway here in East Lansing. The station, just south of East Lansing's existing Amtrak facility, will incorporate rail, city, regional, and national bus lines in one large modern facility. The multimodal gateway is slated to open earlier than originally expected. ETA is sometime this July. WKAR's Peter Wharf met with CATA Assistant Executive Director Debbie Alexander a few days ago for an on-site update.
So we are on the new site of the multimodal gateway that's being built to support the Amtrak service and the intercity bus service to the East Lansing area.
Right, so we're just immediately to the west of the existing Amtrak station.
Yes, that's true. The existing Amtrak station is still in place, which it will come down this summer once the new one is prepared.
Right.
But we are on Harrison and Trowbridge.
The difference couldn't be more striking.
Yeah, it's a brand new facility. It's like triple the size, and it's going to provide much better access and including expanded parking.
It's really taking shape now, really looking like something substantial and impressive on the outside. When was ground broken, and you know, how long have you been working?
Yeah, so the first step was actually to demolish the buildings that were originally here on the property.
What was here?
We had 5 buildings. Michigan State University was using an old printing building, an old warehouse building, and so forth. And those have been demolished. The only remaining building is the Amtrak current station. That was the first step. The second step was actually to clear out the land. The actual land was not structurally sound enough for us to build on, so we had to dig down about 25 feet and then backfill. Did that, and then we started with the foundations for the new building.
Okay.
So just so you know, we're going to have 150 parking spaces on that side. They'll enter through that light, and then they'll come, and this will be, you can kind of see it now, a drop-off area, like I call it kiss and ride, drop-off and leave area. And then you can see the awning here. This is where the buses will now board. They'll have actually 4 different bus boarding areas for the 3 providers. That's Greyhound, Indian Trails, and a Megabus. Would be available to a 4th if that were to come along. And they'll have stations where they can actually board outside under the covered canopy, which, of course, is not available today, a covered waiting area.
The old Amtrak station parking, I don't know if I want to use the word notorious, but there wasn't a lot of parking. You're talking really like 5 times the spaces now, right?
Well, there's about 30 available on the current site,
right.
So up to 150, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, let's go inside.
Okay.
watch your step because it is still, you know, actively under construction.
Right.
Inside the building, we have vestibules that will be open to the public at all times, interior waiting areas, separated from the actual waiting area that will be available when it's manned.
I see.
This will be bike storage area under here.
We're over here on the east side of the building, and you say that this will be bike storage?
Yes, we'll have storage under the covered area, but it will not be enclosed. It'll just be bike racks under this area.
All right.
We're entering the back door. This is actually the storage area for luggage for Amtrak. We have built this facility to allow for TSA to actually have secure luggage scanning if that were to become available or required as part of Amtrak and Greyhound's.
I always wondered about that, getting on the trains here in East Lansing. Basically, you can walk onto the platform and get on.
And carry your own luggage without it being scanned.
Yeah.
And so at this point, TSA has not governed that, but we are preparing the facility in case it does.
Okay.
Now we're actually in the public hall, hallways. This would be all of Amtrak's area, so it would be actually facing the tracks. They can see when the train is arriving. This is their new customer service area.
Right. Floor-to-ceiling windows facing the tracks as we look
north,
right?
That's right. The whole facility is floor-to-ceiling glass. One of the things the customers asked us to do when we did their initial survey was make it very safe. People can see me if I'm in here, and I can see out if I'm in here.
Right.
So that we've accommodated that through as much window as we can.
Good. This is Peter Warf for Current State. I'm speaking with Debbie Alexander, Assistant Executive Director of CATA. We're at the new CATA Multimodal Gateway here in East Lansing. The new development for Amtrak, for Greyhound, for CATA buses, and more.
Yes, that's correct. Indian Trails and Megabus.
Uh-huh. Very good. As we face westward, we're looking at that covered area. This is where I assume buses will pull in.
That's correct. There will be four different bus staging areas outside underneath this canopy. There will be a covered canopy from the building out into the canopy area, and the canopy actually goes over the doors of the buses so that you can board without getting into the rain or snow. The area that you see just outside of that driveway, currently it's that walkway area, is going to actually be for either overflow buses or for taxi cab waiting areas. Currently the cabs wait in the parking area, which gets kind of congested.
That's probably one of the most, as you say, congested and crazy areas regarding the current train station. It's sort of a free-for-all.
Yeah. That's right. So we're trying to isolate areas for them. So they'll be waiting in this area, and then they would have to pull up through the kiss-and-ride area to board their passengers.
Gotcha.
This is another one of the waiting areas, another one of the vestibules. You can see it's completely enclosed. The doors will be all automatically locking on the inside, so they'll be on a timer, and the outside doors will always be available. Inside will be a series of benches for people to wait.
So you can always grab some shelter 24/7, even when the main part of the station is locked up.
When it's not manned. When it is not manned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right.
Nice. Debbie, you've talked a little bit about the safety environment here and ways that you're addressing this with the building. Talk about some of the sustainability issues that you're also looking at and hoping to achieve.
Yeah, so the floor-to-ceiling lights or windows allow for the ambient light to be shared in the building. But the station does have limited hours in which it's open.
Mm-hmm.
So we've also allowed for climate-controlled but not necessarily fully heated and fully air-conditioned vestibules for people to wait in. We are also doing more landscaping to make this a more environmentally friendly area than what it has before. Mostly it was completely buildings and asphalt.
Great.
The flooring, which you're not able to see, has already been poured. It is a concrete floor, aggregate polished, so it makes it easy for people to pull their luggage or for persons who are in a wheelchair to maneuver around the facility.
What do you think will be the greatest immediate benefits that travelers will realize from this mm-hmm. new facility?
First of all, I think East Lansing is going to showcase itself by having a wonderful, very beautiful gateway or welcome to our community. That's certainly a tremendous benefit. But for the customers, I think it's the accessibility, the controlled environment, and the improved parking and waiting areas.
Long term, what are the hopes for growth or expansion?
Sure, we would love to have Amtrak service our facility more than one time a day in each direction. I think that was what we would hope for. In addition to that, we would hope that the intercity bus becomes more popular and this facility becomes more of a gateway for people who are traveling anywhere along the corridor or interstate area.
Debbie Alexander, Assistant Executive Director at CATA, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
This is WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've heard of surfing, you've heard of skateboarding, you've heard of snowboarding. Maybe you've even tried one of them, but I'll bet you haven't heard of golf boarding. Rather than walking or using a golf cart, golf boarders step onto a motorized skateboard-like device to get around the course. It looks like a cross between an oversized skateboard and a Segway. Only one golf course in Michigan currently offers golf boarding. Surprise! Current State Scott Pohl went to Ann Arbor to check it out.
I'm at the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club near Ann Arbor to learn about the first golf boards in Michigan. Members of the club have been invited to a demonstration led by John Kensley, director of golf here and at a sister course in Ypsilanti.
We're just going to take off down the middle of number one, kind of head over by the bunker. We'll make a big soft U-turn and head on back. And this is where you see where this really is a lot of fun and very easy because you're not doing much now.
Part of Kensley's message to these folks is to not be intimidated by the golf boards, not even if you've never been on a skateboard. Operation is pretty simple. You put your bag of clubs on a small rack in front of you, and there's even a drink holder built into the Segway-like handle. The handle is really just to hold on to. You put one foot in front of the other and lean forward to turn right or lean back to turn left. It's designed to prevent jackrabbit starts and sudden stops. I drove one around for a while and couldn't tip it over, zipping around the course in no time. John Kensley.
They're much easier to operate than a lot of people might think when they first look at them. But when you add that to approximately 40 pounds with a full set of golf clubs, it's even that much easier. So it's very easy to work your way around the golf course. And I took it out and made sure that we didn't have any real challenging areas. And there wasn't any area that you couldn't get around with the maneuverability of the golf board.
Now, you have two courses, and I understand you've decided not to have these at the other course. Can you explain why?
Well, we have a little winding creek that goes through the golf course in Ypsilanti. And that golf course, the way that the bridges have been designed, have a pretty severe slope leading up to the bridge and coming off the bridge. There's just not quite enough clearance with regards to the steepness and the clearance of the golf board to go over that.
Yes.
So at some point, we may actually reconfigure those bridges to allow that to happen. But at this point, while we're still making sure that our decision was a good one to bring these on board, this is the facility that's best for that to happen at. And this is a little bit flatter facility. The great thing about these boards is a number of our members found out today is you can take them up and down very severe hills without any problem. But it still takes a while to feel comfortable that you can do that. And we definitely have more hilly terrain over at the Washtenaw Ypsilanti Golf Course.
What do you think this is going to bring to the course in terms of attracting new members maybe? What sorts of benefits might you as a business gain from having these here?
It's a great question. I actually think having the golf boards is something that would tremendously move the needle at a daily fee. I think you get some people that aren't really sure if they want to play golf, and now they see that and say, hey, that's going to be a lot of fun. For a private course, you're more, make a commitment to wanting to be a part of a club? But I think when you look at if you're looking to be a member at a club and you look at all the different options that are out there and so on, one of the things you look at is this club progressive? What kind of things are they doing? And I think this is the kind of thing where you look and say, that's a club that isn't stuffy, still understands the traditions of this great game, but is willing to do some different things and so on. I think as we're talking with some of our members, I think what you might see is some of that more occasional golfer that might play 6 or 8 rounds might now play 10 or 12. So I think there'll be a business uptick for us because of it. But ultimately, I think it's just more the atmosphere and the culture that we're trying to demonstrate to our members and our future members.
Explain to me how or if someone who hears this story wants to try them. You're a private club. Is there access to the club so they can try the golf board?
We're actually doing a preview membership for the month of May. And it gives people an opportunity to test drive the membership, much in the same way we just had a test drive of the golf boards. And so that would be an opportunity to come out and for a very nominal fee be able to play both of our great golf courses, experience the golf boards as well as all the other things that our club has to offer. But we are a private club, and that's important to have that exclusivity for the people that have committed to our membership. So really, if you're not a member or coming along to be a member, then as far as trying the golf boards, unfortunately you'll have to wait for somebody else to have them. But we hope that it will bring in some new members that would love to have a chance to play golf in a little bit different way than it has been played before.
My name's Justin McNeil. I'm the golf board rep for the state of Michigan.
Since this is the first course in Michigan that has them, this must be the only course you're servicing right now, right?
That's correct. Now that the weather is broken, Polo Fields was nice enough to get on board early, and they're the first facility to have it in Michigan, and everyone's really excited.
You're expecting more, though.
Of course. It's funny that once the first adopter is in, a lot more folks are becoming interested and seeing the Facebook videos, and everyone's really excited, so I definitely anticipate more coming on board.
Give me your elevator pitch for why a golfer would want to use one of these.
I think the biggest thing is if you're going to spend 4 hours of your time these days doing any activity, that it has to be something you really love. And the game of golf has needed something to help, excite the sport a little bit. And the golf board, I think, does that, because not only are you playing golf, you get to do something active and have fun riding the course, doing some great turns. So I think people are going to like that. And otherwise, they're saying that you can get around the course in 2.5 to 3 hours as opposed to the normal 4.5-5 hour round. Because now you're going to your own ball as opposed to following everyone else.
And they're fun to use.
They are. We just did a demo here, and everyone came off and loved it. What we find at golf board is that people who use the golf board will return to use it 90% of the time. So I get a call usually once or twice a week from folks in Utah or California who have ridden it out there, who are asking where can they ride the golf board here in Michigan.
Golfers may someday choose the course they're going to play at based on whether they can use a golf board when they get there.
I really think
that
that's
the
case. I really think that's the case. I think this is something that people are now seeing and asking, what is that? And I really do think courses can differentiate themselves by having this at their facility. It's easier than it looks. The other big thing I notice is that the demographic who uses the board, one common misconception is that it's only for young people. And the guys who call me and email me looking for personal use boards are 40 to 60 years old, and it's actually a lot of the older demographic who loves using it, and the board's easy enough to use that you really don't have to be a surfer or any much athletic ability at all. You can just go and ride the board and have a good time.
The people here to try out golf boarding seem to think it could be a fun alternative to using a cart.
My name is Janine Collins.
What appealed to you about coming out for this demonstration?
They just looked fun. I saw a video that the club had posted, and I had a look at it. And, of course, they've been talking about it for a while. And, yeah, just thought it would be fun and wanted to have a look.
What did you think?
I thought it was fun. easier than I thought. I think with a little bit of practice, you get a little bit more comfortable and looser, and it would be even better. But, yeah, definitely fun.
My name is Richard Scott. I've been a member here at the Polo Fields for I don't know how many years, but I've got a very low number, so I was early on.
What did you think of this demonstration?
We were introduced to the concept through the video that we were all required to watch, which was very helpful. And then we were actually kind of excited to get out here and try these, and we weren't disappointed. I think my wife and I both enjoyed the experience. I've reserved one for tomorrow for a round of golf, and I can't wait to get out and try it. They're very user-friendly. I was a little worried about, being able to handle it. Am I going to fall off of this thing? But actually, after just a few minutes, I think the danger will be not to get too confident too quickly. So I'm going to just go slow tomorrow.
I'm Diane Heiss.
And you're also a member here?
I've been a member for about, I'd say, 12 years now.
Were you ever a surfer, skateboarder, snowboarder before?
trying this today?
Not a snowboarder, but I did a lot of skiing, so I was really anticipating something a little bit different. And boy, this was great. It was really fun to get on that board and move around.
Were you someone who approached this opportunity to try it with some trepidation, or were you really looking forward to it coming out here today?
Well, I really wanted to try it, but I also didn't want to embarrass myself by falling off. And I'm very happy to say I wasn't going to fall off. I felt very secure, very safe.
Golf boarding looks like a lot of fun, but it is different from walking or riding a cart. I'd speculate that all the leaning forward and backward to steer it will amount to a core workout that many golfers aren't used to. I also felt it in my arms, but that's due in part to the natural inclination to pull the handle to steer, even though that doesn't really steer it. That might go away once you're fully used to shifting your weight to steer. It won't be for everybody. Can golf boarding attract people who have never set foot on a golf course? Proponents hope that it might draw new and younger players to the game. Maybe today's snowboarders, shredding mountains of snow, will be tomorrow's golf boarders, zipping around America's courses. From the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club near Ann Arbor, this is Scott Pohl for Current State.
And coming up on Current State, there are some 14,000 children in Michigan's foster care program. They come from different backgrounds and have different needs. Each year, the state trains volunteers to review their cases and recommend what's best for these children. Current State's Kevin Lavery takes a look inside the process. Plus, remember Ken Dawson? He's the MSU retiree we talked to in March who's spending the warmer months hiking the Continental Divide. We'll revisit why and update you on his northbound trek to Canada. That's coming up on Current State.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fulton,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen every morning on the way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
On the next To the Point, Chipotle will soon be serving up tacos and burritos that don't contain GMO ingredients. It's one way big food companies are changing their tune to adapt to consumers' socially conscious tastes. But is it really better for the environment and your health? That's next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
To the Point, today at 2 on AM 870 WKAR.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, every day at noon on AM 870. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last Friday, we aired an interview with Jose Carrera, the Director of Clinical Services at St. Vincent Catholic Charities in Lansing. Mr. Carrera spoke of an ongoing program at St. Vincent that evaluates an at-risk child's physical and emotional well-being. Some of those children are in foster care. Today we look at a different facet of the foster care system, and Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to tell us more. Kevin, you met someone who's recently been trained to study foster care cases.
I did, Mark. In 1984, the state of Michigan created the Foster Care Review Board program. It's made up of citizen volunteers outside the system who review mostly randomly selected cases to ensure that foster care kids are indeed getting the proper support. Last week was the annual training for that program. I spoke with two people about this. Kelly Wagner is the Director of Child Welfare Services for the Michigan Supreme Court, which administers the program. I also met Dr. Margaret Hale Smith. She's the Dean of Students at Glen Oaks Community College in Centerville, and she's a brand new review board member. First, Kelly Wagner told me what foster care review board members are looking for.
They'll be looking generally for three broad issues, the first being the child's safety. When the state takes the drastic step of removing a child from his or her home, our number one issue needs to be that child's safety in his or her placement. They'll also be looking at the child's well-being, and these are things like, how is the child progressing in foster care? Are his educational needs being met? Are his physical and mental health needs being met as well? And then the third category is what we call timely permanency. We say timely, which it's very important to note that a child's sense of time is very, very vastly different than an adult's sense of time. So we want to ensure that the children receive timely permanency. So they take that information during the review, and they develop a report that they send to the court with recommendations.
When you talk about timely permanency, are there levels of permanency? And what I'm getting at here is children are in different placements. They're in different settings. Sometimes they're with another family member. Sometimes they're in a more of a residential facility. Are there levels of permanency that move toward an ultimate goal?
Permanency is the ultimate goal. There's adoption if termination of parental rights is required. There is guardianship, placement with another fit and willing relative, and another planned permanent living arrangement.
Margaret, you are going through the training right now to be a volunteer Foster Care Review Board member. What has compelled you to do this?
I live in a very rural area. You're just about as far south in Michigan as you can go before you're in a different state where I live. But it's rural. As a matter of fact, we're the seed corn capital of the world in St. Joe County. I am an educator, but I'm also very involved in my community. And one of the things that you cannot ignore is the fact that we have a very high rate of drug problems there, particularly meth, which is sort of the plague that we all deal with. Unfortunately, a lot of the homes that are trying to cook this nonsense have children, and so we have a very high rate of children being removed from the homes as their parents deal with this problem. Seeing this and understanding this, I saw on the website that they were looking for volunteers to work with foster care. And I'm already involved at the college because I'm very much aware of Western Michigan's efforts to keep children who are aging out of the system, get them in college, and work with their unique needs. So I'm a part of that network. So this is just an extension of my interest in children and my desire to want to make a significant positive difference in their lives.
So living in that rural environment and seeing these circumstances, also you say you're an educator, you're the dean of students at a community college. Do you firsthand see the educational challenges that foster kids are facing?
Absolutely. One of the major problems is the fact that foster children who are ready for college need a safe place to stay. Unfortunately, we don't have residence halls at my college. We're looking at that right now. So I'm always eager to get those children, those young people, they're not kids anymore, connected to Western and other institutions that can meet their needs and are interested in meeting their specific kinds of needs.
We're talking with Kelly Wagner, the Director of Child Welfare Services for the Michigan Supreme Court, also with Margaret Hale Smith, who is an educator and also a volunteer who will be serving on a foster care review board. Kelly, in years past, the foster care review board system has come up with annual reports. One year, the focus was on parent-child visitations, and the report says that good planned parental visits are at the heart of reunification, but it also says that those visits don't always produce the healthy interactions that bring families back together. How is that being worked on?
This is a difficult issue because of the limited resources that the child welfare system has. So efforts are really being coordinated at a local level. For instance, in Cass County, Judge Susan Dobrich has taken a very active role in this issue after seeing the statistics and seeing the positive effects of offering more parenting time when reunification is, in fact, the goal. And so she and her group, her DHHS, all her service, her community service providers, et cetera, have really focused on this issue, and now they have reached out to churches and other community organizations to see if they would be willing to step up and supervise visitation, and also make it so that it's not just parenting time at a DHHS office which is typically a sterile environment. They want to make parenting time more family-like, more realistic. So if you can have parenting time where you're utilizing the skills that you're being taught, that's what we want to see. That's what produces the best results.
And I imagine you have to emotionally prepare both parent and child for these regular meetings.
Correct, correct. Typically, both the child and the parents are very, very excited to see each other during parenting time. And I can't say enough good things about the importance of more frequent parenting time.
Margaret, any thoughts on this? You're shaking your head knowingly here.
Well, I don't know if it's knowingly. I just know the power of relationships and how important it is that we allow people to keep those connections. One of the things I heard yesterday from Judge Sykes that was so important and really resonated with me was that he made the statement that we don't always know how critical it is that these children have a chance to be with the parents, even in what we consider bad situations, that was still their home. And so if we help them, the parents, develop the kind of parenting skills that are more positive, we still want to allow them, as Kelly said, to practice those new skills and give those children a sense that the fact that their parents are still there close by.
As a new board member, Margaret, how much interaction are you envisioning having with parents, foster care parents, children, with anybody who is involved in the system, having a one-on-one relationship with them when necessary?
I'm a type A person, which means I'm totally involved and committed when I take on a new role. So I am looking forward to doing a good job. When I hear from Kelly and from others that I'm making a significant contribution, that's what's important to me.
And what are you learning from this training that is eye-opening or challenging as you're hearing it?
I'm hearing the impact of early childhood development and the impact on the brain at the infant stage has really been eye-opening to me. I consider myself pretty well-read as an educator, but that's one area that is childhood development. I'm not aware of how seriously we can injure our children and how seriously the early stages are involved in the synapses of the brain and the entire physiological aspects of brain development. So that has really made a significant impact on what I've learned today, or I should say on increasing my understanding of that today.
We're talking with Kelly Wagner, the Director of Child Welfare Services for the Michigan Supreme Court, also with Margaret Hale Smith, who is an educator and also a volunteer who will be serving on a foster care review board. Kelly, would you say we have a strong foster care system in Michigan? I realize that's a broad term, but is it generally functional to the level that it's serving the best interest of kids?
Our foster care system, if you look at it from 10 years ago compared to today, there are considerable, noticeable, positive things going on. So yes, Michigan's foster care system has definitely improved over the past 10 years, and most notably over the past 4 to 5 years under the leadership of former Justice and then DHHS Director Maura Corrigan. She's put a lot of resources and spent a lot of personal time trying to improve the foster care system, and it's seen quite a few rewards from that.
And where do we still need to go?
Well, all systems can be improved. I think some of the areas that we could improve on are reunification, a little bit more timely, and our maltreatment and care numbers are still a little bit concerning, although we are now above what the federal level requires. So we've met our target on that, but anytime you have maltreatment while in foster care, it is a concern. So we want to get that number down to zero.
Margaret, you are a professional educator, but this is not really like the classroom. Are you emotionally prepared for this volunteer job?
I certainly believe I am. One of the things you might want to know about me is that I'm a single parent myself, and I didn't go to college until I was nearly 40 years old. So my background is probably pretty similar to some of the people that are struggling with some of these very issues. I'm just grateful that I was more prepared to be able to handle it and had a very strong support system in parents and extended families that helped me do a decent job, I hope. I don't know what my son would say as a parent, but absolutely, I'm looking forward to this, to growing and learning in this new challenge.
Kelly Wagner is Director of Child Welfare Services for the Supreme Court of Michigan. Margaret Hale Smith is a professional educator. She's the Dean of Students at Glen Oaks Community College. Ladies, thanks for having time for me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I'd very much like to thank Margaret and all of the other Foster Care Review Board volunteers for their very important input and commitment to the foster care system.
Thank you, Kelly.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. A recently retired Michigan State University employee is not taking his retirement lying down. Back in March, Ken Dawson told Current State about his plan to spend 5 months hiking America's Continental Divide. The 3,100-mile solo adventure began about 3 weeks ago in southern New Mexico. I connected with Ken Dawson by phone on Saturday as he was passing through Pietown, New Mexico. I'll update you in a minute on how it's going. The Farmington Hills man says he's long had a passion for the outdoors and is dedicating the long, often lonely trip to others.
One of the reasons I'm doing this in a big part is I've always had sales goals and goals my entire, you know, professional career. So I wanted to set a special goal when I retire. So I took what I was really passionate about and my love of the outdoors, and I coupled that with a unique fundraising effort so I could do something to pay back to a community that's been so good to me, and it's a life that's been so good to me. So my passion for the outdoors was matched by an organization called Big City Mountaineers, who works with at-risk kids. And they take these kids on wilderness trips, and they mentor them, one adult to one child. And they take them on these trips, and they teach them how to make better decisions, how to set goals, and more importantly, to instill self-assurance.
You want to average about 20 miles a day, and I guess it'll all work out if you can stick to that. And you dubbed this as a reason to retire, which I loved. If you didn't have this passion, do you think you'd still be working?
Well, no, probably not. I have a lot of interest. I'm very active in different activities, sports. I'm kind of an excessive compulsive when it comes to sports. In fact, my entire family is. So not only do they love the outdoors as much as I do, they all exercise.
Why the Continental Divide?
Well, the Continental Divide is one of the toughest, hardest trails there is in the world, in fact. So I needed to take my skill sets and create a wow factor. And certainly hiking the Continental Divide is a wow. And then I took my sales skills, which is basically taking marketing materials, taking my contacts and my skills to work with people and started to develop. I first did a video, and I had MSU alumni, Carl Rausch, who did this beautiful video for me. And then I took that and then was able to get the State News did a news article that was picked up by the Big Ten Network. And then the Lansing State Journal. So everything just kind of went viral in the multimedia world today. And a lady I didn't know 2 months ago found out what I was doing, fell in love with this program, and has done a lot of the marketing for me. And it's become more than just about me. It's become about us. It's a family affair. My wife's the logistic manager. My daughter spent a week putting the food supplies. Last week, I had 500,000 calories of food put in 28 different boxes, 3,100 calories a day, which is maybe even a little bit on the light side. They're worried I'm going to wilt away on this trip. So they were stuffing the boxes plenty for me.
You are a goal setter, I can tell that. Ken Dawson's our guest, and we're talking about his first retirement project, hiking the Continental Divide Trail. This sounds really rigorous. Lots of peaks and crazy weather and varmints. Do you worry about anything in particular?
No, I think that the dangers are, and everybody asks me about bears.
Yeah.
I'm not too concerned about the black bears too much, but there are grizzly bears out there in parts of Wyoming, especially Montana, the Bob Marshall and Glacier National Park. And the one deterrent of bears is to talk. They will stay away from people if they hear the human voice, but it's a little difficult when you're there by yourself.
So you'll be doing a lot of talking, just not to anybody.
Exactly.
Is that the idea? Well, one grizzly bear encounter can ruin your whole day. What's the highest peak you'll climb?
I think it's around 14,000. I believe it's Mount Elbert, but I'm not sure there. But it's the highest is 14,000. The average is 4, and the lowest elevation is really around 4,400 feet.
And is that at the beginning down in New Mexico?
No, actually, it's at Waterton National Park in Canada.
Oh.
Although in New Mexico, it's what they call the boot heel area, and it's a high desert, about 4,500 feet. The dangerous section is going to be, besides the bears, the inherent danger is lightning. More people die of lightning in the mountains than anything else, because when you get above the alpine area, there's nothing there to protect you. Mm. In the afternoons when the lightning storm comes, you better get down from the mountain.
Camping, motels, what? A combination of the two or what?
No, I have a my luxury lifestyle will be sleeping in a Big Agnes ultralight tent that only actually weighs 1 pound 10 ounces. And I will be camping basically out wherever I find a spot at the end of the day where I stop. Now, there'll be some areas like when I go through Yellowstone, I'll be in like a backcountry site. Every 7 to 10 days, I will resupply in a town. So I will get cleaned up and shaved so I look somewhat presentable and I don't smell as bad as the bears in the woods.
I take it the outdoors became an important ongoing focus, not just for you, but for your family. I know this was really a family affair, and I know it altered your daughter's career path. Tell us about that.
Well, I camped as a kid. I took my family camping. And then when my daughter started college, I wanted to do something special. We went on a backpacking trip to Glacier National Park, and it basically changed all of our lives. My daughter went on to become a wildlife biologist and now works with young students as the wilderness director at the University of Montana. My son became a police officer, an avid climber, had a girlfriend who was an avid climber, and on one of our backpacking trips, he proposed to her on the top of Jonas Pass in British Columbia.
Hmm.
Every year, we've gone backpacking since 1997, and I saw how it enriched our lives and changed our lives. And then I met other people whose kids were troubled and at risk and went through very similar programs. I've had people that donated to me that I didn't even know, and I asked them, "What compelled you to donate?" And they said, "I had a son or I had a daughter that was troubled, and I took them on one of these, or I took them to an organization that took them on these wilderness trips, and now they turn their lives around. They're professionals today. They have families, and I believe in this." And like John Muir said, between every pine tree opens a new door to a new way of life.
Mm. Your beneficiary, again, is an organization called Big City Mountaineers. The blog that you've put together is really impressive, something to behold. CDTJourneyForTheKids.com, CDT for Continental Divide Trail. You've told me that your wife's not that worked up about this because you're spending so much time apart while you're on the trail.
Yeah, this was very difficult for my wife. We have a very unique relationship. We've been married 41 years, and she's my best friend. I almost want to cry here. And she does everything with me. So this has been very difficult for her. And she's my logistics manager. She trains with me. So she's been a real trooper for this whole thing. And she will try to join me on certain aspects of the trail, but she realizes this is pretty tough.
That was my next question. So you will be hooking up with acquaintances and friends on the trail at some point?
Yes, I wanted this trip to be a lot more about me than just me. And that's why with the blog site, I've had a lot of people wanted to follow the trip. So I set up a blog site that's pretty interactive. You can find out where I'm at. I want to do a daily blog, and I have some writers, family members, who will transfer information that I give to them with pictures. And I want to talk about the people I meet along the way, the culture. You know, what is the boot heel of New Mexico? Not just the pains and gains, but, you know, what about the environment and the culture and those kinds of things?
I can't imagine what that first step is going to be like, the first step down at down in New Mexico.
Yeah, it's
called. Have you anticipated that?
Yes, I have, and it's kind of scary actually, because at first it was, you know, about me. So anything I did, I could walk a day and quit. But now, you know, I have a lot of people that you know are following me and are anticipating and wishing me luck. And this is not anything that you can train for. I mean, to hike 20 miles a day average, there are going to be some days I'm going to have to do 35 miles. Mm-hmm. And there's some days in the mountains I'm not going to be able to. In the San Juans, it's going to be snow covered, and the trail's going to be covered with snow. Route navigation is going to be extremely difficult. Map, compass, GPS. Those days I might only get 10, 11 miles. So I have no idea, other than the fact that I think I'm extremely physically fit. And a few other people that have done it, I read their stories, and I said, you know, they can do it. I can do it.
Will somebody be there at the finish line?
I hope so. What question people ask, how are you going to get back home? And I said, well, you know, if I make it there, that's the least of my problems. I'll find a way. And, yes, I think some people will be there at the finish line. I'm sure my wife will.
So nearly 3 weeks into the trek, how is Ken Dawson doing? Through an intermittent cell phone connection on Saturday, he told me it's been challenging but going well. He says he crossed about 100 miles of desert in his first 5 days. He says staying on the Continental Divide Trail, which is intermittently marked by signs, has been a challenge along with the elevation. There's less oxygen at 6,500 feet elevation. All that said, the journey continues. You can follow along at Ken Dawson's blog site, cdtjourneyforthekids.com. The Michigan State University Alumni Association announced a major change last week. Starting in the summer of 2016, it'll no longer require membership dues. I recently spoke with MSUAA Executive Director Scott Westerman about why it's dropping the dues requirement.
Well, it gets down, Mark, to a fundamental definition of why the Alumni Association exists. And we really do exist to engage and enrich Spartans. It's our job to go out there into the world and connect with our alumni and help them lead happier, more fulfilling lives, and to connect them with Spartans who can help them do that. And dues really has no place in that conversation. So we've been thinking about this for a couple of years, trying to figure out what the best way is to do it and how to do it. And we looked at some other folks that had tried it. And we're modeling this very much after the Ohio State model. They did this 2 years ago and ended up with more donors and a higher average dollar per donor amount than they had prior. So we're hoping we'll do the same thing.
And you were breaking this down. You're going to offer basic services and enhanced services. Talk to us about that.
Right. I mean, the a basic level, if you're an alumnus of Michigan State University, we love you. And we'll give you those basic services for free without any requirement whatsoever. And those are pretty much what people are getting now. The only thing that will be different is that if you are not a donor, you won't receive a hard copy of the magazine. You'll get an electronic version of the magazine. And all we ask for you to be considered an active or a basic alumni member is to give us your contact information. So it's as simple as going to msu.edu/connect to do that. And then what we call the Loyal Spartan group are anybody that gives $100 or more annually anywhere in the university. One of the things we really wanted to do is we wanted to turn the focus away from us as an association and allow people to really connect with where their passion was at Michigan State. And this will facilitate that.
Have you heard from any people, though, who have plunked down $750 for a lifetime membership or have paid annual dues year after year?
Well, we actually took, as far as lifetime members go, we've taken that into account. One of the things that's also going on at University Advancement is that they're recalibrating their donor societies. There's a number of those. And lifetime members basically will now fall into one of those higher donor societies that already get the same benefits that lifetime members have always gotten. So there'll be no diminishing of any recognition for a lifetime membership at Michigan State University Alumni Association. We're actually maintaining the status quo. So there won't be much that people will see as a change at that level.
Scott Westerman's the executive director of the MSU Alumni Association. We're talking about their decision to stop collecting dues as a membership requirement as of 7/1/16. Help me understand this cash flow, though. How will the association move forward once dues money stops coming in?
Well, one of the things that we did was we tried to figure out exactly what the dues money was going to, and we found out that a lot of it was going to maintaining the membership model. We're spending a lot of money on marketing and communication just to get people to re-up. And so after we took that out and did a little value engineering like we all do at Michigan State University and talked to some of our corporate underwriters about providing a little bit more support, we really got within striking distance where we could make this happen.
Some people don't give to individual colleges at MSU, but they certainly do give to MSU athletic programs. Is there a place for them in this framework somewhere?
They're totally included. It really is $100 or more on an annual basis to any part of the institution, and that includes the Spartan Fund. We really want to welcome as many of those folks into our fold as possible, because overall, what we're trying to do at University Advancement is create this culture of philanthropy, which is so key to the future of our institution. As you've talked about many times before on Current State, the public funding for education is a diminishing return right now. And we don't expect it to get better anytime soon. So what we're doing is, in essence, what previous generations have done for us, and that is, you know, stepping up to write the checks, to build the buildings, to endow the professorships, and to make sure that the Spartan experience is available for future generations.
Scott Westerman is executive director of the MSU Alumni Association. The MSUAA will stop collecting dues as a membership requirement as of July 1st of next year. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, people aged 85 and older make up the fastest growing age group in America. For the past year, students in the MSU School of Journalism have been documenting the life stories of seniors in our state. We'll hear about the students' Living History Project. Plus, have you ever taken a walk and suddenly felt the urge to bust out Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1? Well, of course you have. But there's never a piano on the street corner when you need one. A new project in Lansing this summer will satisfy that nearly universal craving. We will explain tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, and Drew Hill. Past editions of Current State at WKAR.org. And don't forget the podcast. It's all there 24/7 on your mobile device. I'm Mark Bayshore. Join us Tuesday. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.